Well, Lord, we do appreciate your goodness. Love toward us, Lord, is really wonderful. May you keep us, help us, Lord, so we're not swept away with the world. Thank you for that, Lord. I pray again, as I pray this morning, Lord, that we'll know exactly what you're thinking, what you're saying, how we can prepare for your coming. I thank you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, I wanted to say two things about what I said this morning about the electronic games. One is to the parents. I don't know at what age a child becomes where he has to make up his own mind, but I wonder if it isn't 12. I know the Jews figure when a boy is 12, they do bar mitzvah, he's a son of the law. I wouldn't be surprised if Adam, when he was created, was 12. I wouldn't be surprised at all of that. And I'm saying that to say this. If you just don't... Okay, let's say a child is really involved in the electronic games. I don't think it's a good idea to prove that you're the boss by taking them and throwing them away. I don't think that's a good idea if you can avoid getting into a contest. Because they're not productive, because the child just figures, I get old enough, I'm out of here. So that's not your goal. Your goal is to have the child in a right relationship with Jesus. Is that correct? And if you get where it's an adversary relationship, that's, you might prove that you're stronger and bigger and in charge, but you didn't accomplish your goal. So it's what's called a Pyrrhic victory. You won the battle and lost the war. So my suggestion is to take the approach of reason, as I did this morning. Here's things that you can do. Watching these games will put holes in your armor, and they certainly will. I know that from experience. When that's the way Satan works. He lulls you to sleep, and you think everything is fine, and he waits until you're really weak, and then he turns on you. That's how he operates. So we know darkness is coming, so we need to really take heed to Philippians 4:8 and keep our minds on that, which is lovely, because it's going to give us strength when we need it. You see, and I think a child at the age of 12 is able to understand that. And then it's up to you as a parent to use whatever controls you feel are necessary, trying to avoid an adversary relationship, not being arbitrary, reason. You know, any youngster knows if they spend 4 hours a day on an electronic game, that's not healthy. They know that. If they don't, it's almost hopeless. But by the time they get 16 or 17, then they really have to make up their own mind. If you force them, I still think you lose the war. It's up to them, and by the time they're 16 or 17, God will judge them. You don't have... God will judge after you've explained to them what they're doing wrong, and they still insist on it, then they're facing Jesus. So I know it's hard, and I know some parents get into an adversary relationship with their child when it could be avoided. Sometimes it can't. So it's an art. It's really not a science. You have to kind of dance with it. But I said that so parents won't get all righteous. And it reminds me of a story by McDonald. There was this grandmother, and she felt she was very holy and everything, and she was raising a grandson. And he didn't have any friends or anything, but he did have a violin. And he would practice that violin. That was, to him, was so important. Well, when the grandmother found out about it, she took the violin and threw it in the fire. Religious people will do these kinds of things, and they feel perfectly righteous. But what it is religious meanness. It's not. You would... Better to teach the child the love of Christ and let him practice on the violin than to say it's of the devil. But anyway, it's been true of Christian families, and they've driven their children away, and some of them are too loose and some are mean, and on it goes. So I'm just throwing in my 2 cents. Go easy with it and tried to get the child's heart. Another thing that I want to mention, after I got through listing these activities, two men who had not communicated came up to me and they said, "Why didn't you include reading?" Boy, it hit me like a bombshell, because I realize that our culture, which comes largely from England, is really contained in stories. Now, when I grew up, there was no television, and I did a great deal of reading, and so I'm pretty well acquainted with the children's, what I would call classics, like Robinson Crusoe and Treasure Island and the Three Musketeers and Gulliver's Travels and so on. And then it hit me. I'll bet you some of these kids have never read Gulliver's. Have any of you read Gulliver's Travels? Oh, you have? You read it in school? You had to. a child will say, "But I saw the movie." But you see, the movie is not the same. When an author, movies are what you call plot-driven. That is, the characterization, the author's nuances, allusions, and all that are not present. And so a really gifted author puts an awful lot into a story. I'm thinking, for example, of Johnny Tremaine. Have any of you kids read Johnny Tremaine? Well, that was written by, I don't think her name is Esther Forbes, I believe. And she was a scholar, and she wrote on the American Revolution. And as a spinoff, she wrote this book for children, well, sixth graders, fifth grade on up. And it could endure fifth grade through the senior in high school. It's really, really a classic. I think it's a Newbery Award, Johnny Tremaine. And it's a shame to miss that book. You could never put that in a movie. There's so much in there where he burned his hand pouring the silver, and Paul Revere, who was a silversmith, and all that. See, she writes from an immense amount of data. And it is so good, and it is so where he thinks he's in love with this girl, and then he sees an apple on the ledge of the window, and he looks up, and apple is rotten. Well, he takes that as a sign that the girl doesn't love him. See, this kind of thing would never appear in a movie, but it's so true to people that when you say, "I saw the movie," I figured, well, you shortchanged yourself, because I remember seeing the movie of Lydia Bailey, and boy, if they didn't miss that by 25 miles, it just was not Lydia Bailey, whatever. That's another. Kenneth Roberts is very skillful at nuances of human behavior, and that's the riches of a book, not the symbolism, as in Moby Dick. That, I don't know, college literature professors go crazy over that, finding the white whale means this, and Ahab means this, and that native means this and that. I'm not into that. Now, some are, and that's fine. Maybe all that symbolism is there. Maybe Herman Melville never thought of it when he wrote it. I don't make out of it. Sometimes you can make out of my stories whatever you want to, but they're just stories. And so I don't know whether that's the truth with Moby Dick, but I expect in some cases there may be an element of truth in it. But I'm just talking about reading to enjoy what our culture has brought forth. And it's rich. It goes all the way from The Little House on the Prairie to A Tale of Two Cities and everything in between, and it's rich. The Laura Ingalls Wilder, the seven books, I think it is, on The Little House, marvelous. And the values in The Little House series are marvelous. These were the days when Americans were settled. Well, they start off with The Little Home on the Prairie in Wisconsin, and they go to The Little House on the Prairie in Kansas, and then they're forced out when the Indians were given the land by the government, and they go. But the values of hard work and God-fearing people, see, that is the root of America. That's what made America great, is that kind of values. Horatio Alger, you know, and this kind of thing. And we have right now, see, back around, it must have been around 800 A.D., something like that, the Muslims very nearly conquered Europe. They got as far as, and a general by the name of Charles Martel, the Hammer, stopped them. And they had to go back to their homes in the Middle East. But you see, they had a tremendous culture. In fact, our numerals today are from the Arabs. That's why we call them Arabic numerals. They were the light of civilization in their time when Europe was in the Dark Ages. But they never succeeded in conquering Europe any more than the Mongols did. But they now they're doing it. And they're doing it by having people immigrate and then set up their values. And England is very close to becoming a Muslim nation. Now, England is really the bastion of Christianity as far as Europe is concerned. And our Christianity came over from England with the Puritans. So we see that our culture is really in danger of being overrun. In fact, I remember one time at Stanford, the students were chanting, "Western Civ has got to go, Western Civ has got to go." Well, see, this is this Western civilization. See, this is what America is, what England used to be, what Scandinavia largely is. South America's a little different there. But the Muslims are making tremendous inroads, but they're not doing it as they did back in the days of Charles Martel. They're not doing it with the sword. They're but taking advantage of democracy and of freedom of speech. They're smart. Well, I don't think the Muslim religion is, I suppose, no better, no worse than any other religion. But you see, our hope is not in religion at all. Christian religion has done some terrible things in its history to the Jews and to people who didn't believe. So our posture is not as Christians. It's as we're following a man who is the only tree of life, who is the only atonement for sin. And I don't care how you compromise your religion, it doesn't matter. There's only one atonement. There's only one tree of life, and it's not the Christian religion. So well, the Muslim religion has a lot of things in it that are very detrimental to women, and it's trying to force its way here and establish the prayer towers, you know, where you wake up in the morning hearing the tape recording of the Muslim as he recites the prayer to Allah. That's, I don't know, I think we have some mosques in this country. There's a lot of them in England. So see, they're conquering. They know what they're doing. They're conquering. It's a religious thing. They believe, and the Quran teaches, that if someone is not a Muslim, he can be killed. Well, you see, our Bible teaches that in the Old Testament. That's what God says. If anybody mentions a God different from me, stone him to death. Burn the village down. Slay everything in it. Did you know that was in the Old Testament? Talk about tolerance. So it's a circuitous problem with all kinds of little ramifications and ins and outs and subtleties and nuances. But for us, see, I'm speaking now, I won't be here probably, nor will Audrey, to see much of what's going to develop over the next 30 years. But I would say that America's going to change rapidly. And the only way we're going to survive as a person is to know Jesus and to follow him. Now, I don't know how God will let the Muslim religion come. It's not good. It's not good. Neither is the Christian religion. Christian religion has murdered I don't know how many people up until the beginning of the 20th century in South America. There, the Catholics were still killing Protestants up until about 1940 when there was a papal edict forbidding it. But as late as 1940, they were still persecuting the evangelicals in South America. So the hands of the Christian church are bloody. So that's not what we're defending. What we're trying to do is to follow Jesus and do what he would have us to do, to survive ourselves and help our loved ones to come to know Jesus, not religion, not Christianity, not the church, the man. When you keep that fixed in your mind, you'll be clear. And when I talk about electronic games, I'm not talking about it's against the Christian religion. I'm telling it will interfere with your walk with the Lord. And if that happens, you'll have nothing. See? Now, on top of that, we have the question of reading. And I'm not saying that I listed, what, maybe 20 activities. They're back on the posted on the bulletin board back there. I'm not saying for everybody it's going to be reading. But for some it could be. And I'm going to try to come up next Sunday with some of the books that I am acquainted with that are really good and wholesome and the values are good, that some girls and boys may use that as their activity. Now, others may be weightlifting. It may be inventing something. It may be whatever that I've listed, the whole bunch, you know. You can, and you probably got 30 or 40 more in your own mind that you can think of. But these are all productive. And the value of reading is it gives you a feeling for where we came from, our roots, the Western civilization roots. And if you lose that and lose Jesus too, you won't have anything, any anchor to keep you stable. From then on, it'll just be the vicissitudes of life. And pretty soon you'll figure, what is this? You know, everybody's a crook, and the government's rotten through and through, and pretty soon you'll have nothing. You'll go to drugs or booze or something, or move to Tahiti. So if you want to be a solid person, producing something worthwhile, possibly having a family, then you've got to decide who you are, what you're doing. You can't drift. See, the electronic games are drifting. That's just drifting. That's just delaying. It's like coming home with a bunch of problems and watching the television solve nothing. Solved absolutely nothing. You just sat there while it fried your brain. That may be where Alzheimer's coming from, actually. Because to learn something, you have to interact with the medium. And if you're there and it's completely passive and this is pouring in, I don't know. Could be one of the causes of Alzheimer's. I don't know. I just know it's not healthy. And electronic games are not healthy. So if you're reading the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, or you're reading Johnny Tremaine, or you're reading Robinson Crusoe, and I know that I think it was Gulliver's Travels that has a political agenda, something like the Mother Goose rhymes. They're all, you know, they're all political satires and all. But that's our civilization. That's our culture. Now, I don't know about the Filipino culture. I haven't known enough of the Filipino culture, but I'm sure there are roots there that they can say, I'm a Filipino. This is where I come from. This is what our country believes. But you see, that's not true in America, a nationality. See? We may be called that, but well, I shouldn't say that. We're not a race. See, the Filipinos are a race. So they've got an anchor there. I'm a Filipino. When we say I'm an American, you see, now our country, as anyone could have predicted, is being divided along racial lines. This last election was pure racism. Pure racism. If Mr. Obama had been white, I don't believe he ever would have been elected with his track record. But the black people put him in. I'm not criticizing it. I'm not saying anything against the black people or the white people or anybody else. I just want you to see what's happening in our country. We're having strong problems because we're not a race. And the blacks are a race. The Latinos are a race. The Irish are a race. So what's happening is, and I saw back 50 years ago, This idea of a melting pot went a long time ago. America is becoming a number of segmented that are grappling for power. Of course, they clothe it with all nice philosophy, but it's basically a struggle for power. And it may, Putin of Russia, the prime president, said America lasts till about 2010, and then it'll be destroyed by racial. See, they can see that looking at us. They say, he says racism will destroy the United States by 2010. And see, a man of his stature, they have, not supernatural, but they have unusual ability to perceive what's going on in nations. I can see it shaping up. Right now, they're trying to declare the election of the president void because it wasn't constitutional. If the courts ever ruled on that, you talk about race riots. Whoo! We haven't seen Watts seem like kids in the nursery. Yeah. So the potential is there. And if you don't know who you are and where you are and what you're doing, you're going to be rootless and swept around by powerful currents. And God doesn't want that. He wants you to know who you are. And one way, and not the only way, is by reading the classics. Certainly, as I said, all the way from Little House on the Prairie, all the way up to A Tale of Two Cities, Oliver Twist, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, The Three Musketeers. Every American child, boy or girl, should know these books. Treasure Island, and some of the classic poetry also. And then Tony can tell you about the Iliad and the Odyssey. These are fundamental to our thinking. And when we spend our time on electronic games, you see, we're culturally rootless. We don't have Jesus. We don't have our values, our cultural values. And so we're an easy mark for the Muslims. Easy mark. We have nothing. They know where they're going, but we don't. We're sitting amusing ourselves with games. So that's why I'm saying it. Not to say we're naughty, naughty, naughty. I'm trying to, because young people today are unusually intelligent, and I think a lot of it is due to better nutrition. And they can understand. These kids here can understand exactly what I'm saying. And they'll make their own decisions. Their parents won't make them for them. Their parents may force something on them, but they'll reserve in their mind. That's not what I want. This is what I want. So I'm trying to reason. I'm trying to say that get a grip, because the things are shaping up. I thought it would be another 4 years before we had a real left president. But we've got him, which tells me the time is foreshortening. See, and because already there are decisions which are inimical to our values being made, like tax money to support abortion clinics overseas and so on and on. It will go on and on like this more and more as they're able to get away with it, because it's a struggle of power. See, they clothe it with nice words, but it's a struggle of power. And of course, there's evil forces behind abortion. Evil forces. So no matter what you say about reproductive rights, it is murder. And but see, the majority of the country doesn't believe that, so they put in a president who is supportive of abortion. That's why our country cannot be successful. As long as that murder is going on, we cannot be successful. So that means we're on our own. That's cool. That's happened a lot of times in history where kids have had to take a stand in times of war and times all the way back from Genghis Khan and the Mongols attacking the European countries and so on. It's always been when young people have lost their parents and have had to make their own values and their own homes and everything. That's what we're coming to. And so I say the secret there is in Philippians 4:8. Keep your mind on that which is lovely. Keep your mind on that which is true. Keep your mind on that which is honorable. And these books that I've mentioned to you have those values. You'll never find better values than in the Little House on the Prairie series. Boy, they are fundamental American values, God-fearing, hard-working, honesty, all the things that America used to stand for. So that's one activity. And as I say, I'm going to try to collect about 25 real good titles and present them next Sunday so that those who choose reading as an alternative. Now, not all young people are going to do that. But those who do will know what to ask for in the library. In the modern books, I don't have any use for them because most of them have got all kinds of sexual stuff in them and everything. And they're just not written like the old books were. They're just not written like that. They're written, they play on the publishers say, put something in there real sexy so it'll sell. You don't get artistic works that way. Artistic works come out of blood, sweat, and tears. All right, now we're in what I've been talking about today is preparing the way of the Lord. That's what I'm talking about, is preparing the way of the Lord. So let's go back to Isaiah 40. And this first thing in Isaiah 40 is not really as appropriate for young people as is my discussing electronic games. But you'll face it someday. And adults will be facing it. If you haven't, then pray that you'll stand in the day of testing. Because how many remember the scripture in Hebrews 12? Every son whom God receives, he chastens, that he may be a partaker of his holiness. He doesn't do that immediately. He waits until he figures you can stand and take it. And when it comes, you need a lot of prayer to stand. And you'll see it right here. It's in several places in the Bible. Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed. King James says warfare has been accomplished. Now notice this, that her sin has been paid for. But notice how it's been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Double what? Double chastening. Now you'll see the same thing in Isaiah 12:1. And this is where you come to know yourself. You remember the poet Robert Burns of Scotland in his poem entitled The Louse, because he wrote it because he was sitting back of a lady in church. And she had a very fancy hat, something like someone I won't mention. And as he was sitting there, there was a louse. That's a singular for lice. A louse was crawling up the back of her hat. So he wrote this poem called The Louse. And there's a phrase from it that is very famous. Do you know what it is? Yeah. Would God the gifty gee us to see ourselves as others see us. See, because the lady was so proud with her hat. So it's in this confrontation that every son of God who's coming to maturity must experience. And in that confrontation, God shows you yourself. And before that time, your picture of yourself is probably quite different from the way others see us. Give us the gifty that see ourselves as others see us. And you see yourself. And so that's what he means. Your hard service, your warfare is a better word. And notice in Isaiah 12:1, in that day is when God meets you. See, he doesn't meet you right away. You accept Christ and God puts his Passover blood over you and keeps you. But he doesn't meet you. Remember how he met Jacob on the way back after all those years working for those wives? And he came back and there was Esau with 400 men riding to meet him. And he went across the Brook Jabbok by himself and prayed until his hip was moved out of his socket. Notice, although you were angry with me. See, we don't picture that. But you see, when God receives us, we have an awful lot in our personality that God does not want and will not accept. But he doesn't deal with that. Pastors have to learn that too. You're going to see things in people as well as in yourself. You don't jump the first time you find out somebody is haughty or somebody is dishonest or somebody's a hypocrite or what. You don't jump on them. You got to give them time. And God works with them. But there does come a time in our Christian life when God says, okay, I think they can make it. And he is a gambler. You remember when the apostles were arguing about who should be the greatest? What did Jesus say? To Peter. See? Yeah. He said, Satan has desired to sift you as wheat. And I have prayed for you that your faith doesn't fail. Because they were arguing about who was going to be the chief among themselves. And so that's what Satan was looking for. Motive, agenda. Where's this guy coming from? And Jesus didn't say, I'm not going to let him sift you. He says, I'm going to pray for you. Because it will be a battle of your faith. Just like we saw this morning from Misty. The cloud of unknowing. And the cloud of unknowing. What are you doing, God? I've tried to be a good Christian. I've tried to be a faithful person. I've tried to do this. And what is this? You were angry with me. Why? You don't even know. I see things in your personality that you don't see. Others may see them, but you don't see them. And I can't have it in my kingdom. Your anger has turned away, and you have comforted me. What was he angry with? The things in our personality that are not pleasing to him. Right? Same thing as Isaiah 40. We find it again in Isaiah 54. Same thing. It has to be every son whom he receives. He chastens, he whips, that the boy may be holy, or the girl may be holy. And in Isaiah 54, there he goes. There's Lloyd. He's got it. All right, I have to see. It's down further in the chapter. Okay. You'll see the same thing. Verses 7 and 8. For a brief moment, I abandon you. And see, that's what you feel like when the cloud of unknowing comes over you. It feels like God has abandoned you. Where have you gone? I've served you. I've sung your songs. And now look at me. Like Job. You know, the elders used to put their hand over their mouth when I sat down in the gate. And now they're the people that take care of their pigs, wouldn't even talk to me. Boy, that's when you get insight into yourself. When you think you're a real hot Christian and you imagine that people are really respectful of you, and what they're thinking in their heart is, I wish you would sit down and shut up. Really? But they smile at you. Well, how are you, sister? Well, God has to show us. Am I coming through? All right. For a brief moment, and it is, it seems like forever. It seems like forever. You can't even remember what it was like to be happy in the Lord. Remember this, because if you've never been there, you're going to need to pray for faith to stand, that you don't turn on God and say, I hate you, God, because you're letting things happen to me that I didn't think would ever happen. I thought you wanted me to be happy, and now I'm on the bottom looking. I'm so far down, I'm looking up at the bottom. That's what I said when I first came to Bowie several times. I'm so far down, I'm looking up at the bottom. And you don't know how long it will last. But I'll tell you how long it will last. As long as necessary. To get you to where you can walk humbly with God. Without being so stuck on yourself for being a religious busybody. That's not very kind, is it? For a brief moment I abandon you, but with deep compassion I will bring you back. You will, it will. Let me tell you again. It's not a grave, it's a tunnel. Boy, did I hang on to that in those days. It's not a grave, it's a tunnel. I'm going to come out of here someday. And so he does. I can remember it intellectually, but I can't relate to it emotionally. In a surge of anger, you see that anger again? The same thing that you saw in Isaiah 12. And of course, Christians would be dismayed. God would be angry with me, and then they faint. What did Jesus say about those he loved? I rebuke them. Can you stand the Lord's rebuke if he comes and tells you you're not as hot as you think you are? You're pretty small stuff. You're not a big power in my kingdom. You're just a little mouse. In a surge of anger, I hid my face from you for a moment. But with everlasting kindness, I will have compassion on you. You know who it's talking about? The members of the New Jerusalem. When you read down, you'll see this is talking about the New Jerusalem. Now, you say, yes, that's all true. But now we're in the New Testament. We're all saved by grace. So let's go to 1 Peter 4. I don't want you to... John said, oh, no. Oh, what's coming now? Ever read 1 Peter 4, John? Yeah, okay. Then you know what I'm going to talk about. Arm yourself also with the same attitude, that is, with suffering. Now, that can get gloomy, but if you have a real heart to love Jesus and you want his will above all, and he says that suffering's part of the package, then you say, praise the Lord. But if you're hanging on to the world, you're not going to find pleasure in 1 Peter 4. You know, if you clutch anything, any relationship, any possession, any situation, you will destroy your love, joy, and peace. You've got to open your hand and let God give you what he wants to give you. You say, I can't stand it because there's things I have to have. Not really. You think you do. And sometimes when we have that attitude, I have to have this or that, God takes it in order to teach us that we don't. God is seeking our freedom from idols because idols cause us pain. They destroy our love, joy, and peace. And so you don't clutch anything. I notice in Job, people only repeat, and Colleen only repeated half of that verse. It says, though he slay me, I will trust him. But the rest of the verse says, but I will maintain my own way before him. That's a little different. And Job was maintaining his own way until he saw God. And then he realized, I'm really dust and ashes. See, you see, that was Job's time of confrontation. And let me tell you, the book of Job has been a comfort to numerous Christians when the cloud of unknowing comes over them. But you see what Job learned? I am dust and ashes. Before that, he was a righteous man, keeping all the commandments and having his children keep all the commandments. When God finished with him, he didn't say, I'm a righteous man. He said, I'm dust and ashes. And that's what God's anger does for us. And you can see the anger is kind of like anger when God begins to talk. Now, enough of this, he says to Job. Gird up the loins and stand up like a man. Where were you when I created the world? You know, you could tell, I think, Lord sometimes can get real sassy like that. Now notice this. He who has suffered in his body is done with sin. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't care about suffering, but I do care about being done with sin. That's more important to me than suffering. Paul says that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings. It's through this that we get delivered from the world, from lust, and from self-will. And it ain't fun, but it's bearable in Jesus, but it makes us what we want to be. If I ask anybody in this room, I say, would you like to be in the full image of Christ? Everybody in this room would say yes. Well, this is the way. This is the way. There's no other way. You can't have Adam and Christ. Every believer is two people. Did you know that? Did you know that, Abby? You didn't know that way. You know it now. Every believer is two people. One is temporary. The other one is eternal. Now, we can't see that eternal person. In most of us, it's a very small child. We may be 6'1" and weigh 280 pounds, and be able to press 400 pounds over our head. It's temporary. But that little child that's growing in there is eternal. And your job and your first personality is not going to agree with it. But your job is to nourish that second person, because he's the one that's going to live forever. The first one's going to go, just like it says in Isaiah 40, grass in the field. It's just temporary. You'll see that in older people as they begin to get old. If they haven't kept their mind active, they get cranky and crabby and self-centered, and all they can think about is themselves. And they don't care the discomfort they put on young people, and they just go to pieces. And then all the sins that they've kept repressed, gossip, jealousy, spite, everything all comes out. They can't control it anymore. That's the first man, Adam. But the second person that has been born of Jesus can't sin. So when we're talking here about suffering in the body, we're talking about God whipping the first personality to keep him in shape. Huh? That's not very pleasant, is it? As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires. Evil human desires. But for the will of God. Isn't that wonderful? Peter certainly had suffered enough. They say he was crucified upside down, church history says. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. You give people freedom from restraint. Every time they'll go into lust, they may conceal it in all fancy terms like New Age and arcane philosophies and all this other. It always ends up in free love, because that's in the human nature. That's what happened to Israel. As soon as Moses was on the mountain, they were all in through free love. That's where people go, where they clothe it in all kinds of fancy terms. They think it's strange that you do not plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. Anybody heaped abuse on you, or are you living like the world? But they will have to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. See, we're way too bound with the division we put between life and death, between this world and the spirit world. I invite you to wipe that out. I invite you to begin to think about how you want to live, what you want to do in the spirit world. Jesus knew before he died what he was going to do. after he died, you can too. And that's what I've been writing about in God Will Castle, and also a children's book called God's Wonderful World. Because it dawned on me that when little children are in terminally ill, and Audrey has a niece who's a supervisor of the McDonald House back east that deals with terminally ill children. She had a music career. She's musical. And then her 12-year-old son, Joel, was killed. And he was a sparkler, and that makes it hard. She dropped the music and became a supervisor in a McDonald House. That was years ago. She's got to be in her 60s now. So I sent my book, God's Wonderful World, to her to critique, because she deals with dying children all the time. Now, here's the reason, Shannon. If you've got a little boy or girl, say 10 years old, 8 years old, and they're down in Children's Hospital and they have terminal cancer, they know they're going to die, you're there to comfort them, and they say, Mommy, Daddy, what's it like to die? What do you think the parent's going to tell them? Remember, you're dealing with a child, maybe a 9-year-old child. What are you going to tell them? In all of my life as a Christian, I've never seen that problem dealt with. Because a child does not want to hear about a mansion. They don't want to hear about a backyard full of diamonds. They don't want to hear about playing a harp. They don't want to hear about golden slippers. So what are you going to tell them? Nothing. Say, well, you'll be with Jesus. Will I have any friends? Hope so. See, it's like we don't discuss it. We don't understand, because we put such a wall between this world and the next that we can't deal with it. Well, when I started God Will Castle over a year ago, I had an impression that I should write this because of the Holocaust that is coming to America, and all these people die, and parents are going to die, and children are going to wonder where their parents are. Children are going to die, and parents are going to be screaming in grief and anguish, and I just felt to write this. And I wrote it as a series of impressions. They weren't visions. I could feel within myself what to write. It's a long book. It's over 500 pages. This God Will Castle. And then someone suggested to me, why don't you write something for children? And I said, that's what I've been waiting to hear. So I made a kind of a knockoff, just a part that would appeal. It's only about 35 pages. But a 9-year-old child could read that and know exactly what's going to happen when they die. Because it just goes into... Then you say, well, how do you know? I'm just going impressions. But listen, Uncle Tom's Cabin, did you know this, Lloyd, was written by Harriet Beecher Stowe as a series of impressions? When she'd get through writing one, another impression would come. And that book was largely responsible for the Civil War. Uncle Tom's Cabin. Probably haven't read that. Have you read it? Oh, you read that? Okay. That's good, because I about flop over here if you hadn't read Uncle Tom's Cabin. That's got to be it. But that's what I had. I had a series of impressions. In fact, I was through with it, and I felt a distinct impression. Go back and describe the holy city more than you did. And I... Someone said to me, well, you said in your story that... After you've been in the spirit world for a couple of days, it suddenly dawned on you, you hadn't prayed all that time, and you used to pray in all this time. What happened? And I suddenly came to myself. I realized I'm not praying. So I immediately, because you know my thing about being close to Jesus all the time. And I told this person, it's because while I was writing the story, I was living it. And I was so involved with what was happening to me when I passed between the saints, and then between the warrior angels, and then meeting Jesus in the meadow, and my guardian angel, and these three huge animals that God gave me some time ago. They're not familiar spirits. They represent my personality in war. and my dog Bear was there and everything. And then I went and I saw Godwill Castle, and I was so I forgot to pray. See, I was living the story, and that's why I forgot to pray. But it's that real. And so when I wrote the children's book, if it isn't like that, so it isn't. But boy, I think it is. And what it talks to the children about is who meets them, who loves them, Jesus, where they go, where they live. If they're below the age of, 5, I think, they go to Playland. And I describe Playland. If they're older than that, they go to a community. If their parents are there, the parents take them. If not, people take them in until their parents come. It's all in detail. This is exactly what will happen to you. And it's a lot to do with animals, and it's a lot to do with other kids and everything. Now I ask you, isn't that better than telling a child he's going to go to a mansion with a backyard full of diamonds? What he's interested in is his loved ones, family, and animals. That's what a child wants. His loved ones, families, and animals. I don't want to go into why I think animals will be there, but you say families? Doesn't it say they're not marrying or giving in marriage? Precisely. But it doesn't say there won't be families. You say, well, I don't understand it. Well, give it time. Of course there'll be families, and of course there'll be children. What in the world? Will you want to go to a life where there's no families, where there's no children being born? Dear Lord, and this kingdom is going to go on forever? By a million years, you'll know everybody there? Oh, no. And the new stars will be places where you can immigrate. Because pretty soon, see, since nobody dies, the population will vastly exceed the new earth as huge as it is. It won't take long. There's, 80 million people born now in a year? 80 million people. And if nobody dies of the increase of his kingdom, there should be no end. People, it's a real world. And we've got to learn to make it real, to talk to Jesus and tell him. And there's no problem saying, I hope this happens, or I hope my pet will be there. Like April, they just lost a pet. I know my dog Bear is going to be there because I saw angels when Bear died. Now that surprised me immensely. But if you read in Isaiah, you'll see there's a kingdom. God is very much into animals. That'll make Melissa happy. God is very much into animals. When he saved 8 people on the ark, who else did he save? All the animals. Because God has given us animals. It's just part of life. The domestic and the wild. Bats. Everything you can think of. Satan can't create anything. They all tell us something about God. The Amur tiger, they used to call them Siberian tigers. The right name now is Amur tiger. The Amur tiger, as fierce as that animal is, the largest of the cat family, God made that animal. And someday they'll be tame. In my book, The Children Ride On, I have a pet, Amur tiger. His name is Kamur. And they ride on his back and he goes around showing off. 4 kids on his back. And watcher, a bald eagle with a 10-foot wingspan, always watching, watching, watching. Go see, the spirit world is where sin began. Listen, the next world is real. I can't tell you you're going to be alive tomorrow. But I will tell you you're going into the spirit world. Why not ask Jesus? I'm not asking you to be woozy or woo or weird or anything of that kind. Does the Bible say or does it not? Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. If we get too earthly minded, we're no heavenly good. Jesus was very heavenly minded. Sure, he lived in both worlds at the same time, and he knew what was going to happen to him after he died, that he was going to come back and set up his kingdom. Why don't you ask the Lord? Say, Lord, I want to talk to you all the time. And make your prayer life a romance. And God might, who knows what he might show you. If you take the time to talk to him. But if you get all bogged down in the earth and the economy and everything else, you're killing yourself and it's not necessary. You need to romance a little. get the romance of the Christian life. That's why the Song of Solomon is there. It's, you know, the mountains of leopards and the hills of spices. And so we don't get all occupied with the economy and the government. Okay? Yeah, I'm not going to take any more. I wanted to get down to one verse, and I don't have time, so I can't. But the verse is 1 Peter 4 something, and it says, don't be surprised at the fiery trials. So what I'm saying is, when it comes, just pray for faith to stand. It will come to an end, and you will know God like you've never known Him. Shall we stand? I didn't intend to talk to you about all these things, but I did, didn't I? That's my world I like to live in. So I'm waiting for Audrey's niece to write back and tell me if it's going to go in the McDonald house. But I could picture a little boy or girl reading that till they say, oh, Mommy, this will be wonderful. Just like Christmas. Lord, oh, Jesus, the Son of Man who is in heaven. Lord, lift our eyes. Lift our eyes, Lord. This God knows the problems on the earth, and we all have them, and they tend to bow us down, and there's this cloud of unknowing. We don't know why, and when we serve the Lord, this happens, that happens, and we're clutching things, and we're afraid to death. This will happen, and that will happen. Lord, help us. Help us, Lord, to just relax in You and know that to die is gain. To live is Christ, to die is gain, because we go into a better world. Oh, my goodness me, such a better world, so beautiful, so peaceful, so lovely, so right. Your world, Lord, Your world. So when the Holocaust comes to America, help us to look up above the clouds and realize our home is close at hand, because we're not at home here. This is not our home. Our home is with Jesus. So help us, Lord, not to be earthly bound, but to have some part of our personality that's in the heavenlies. I thank You for that, Lord, in Jesus' name. How many remember that? Any questions about anything I said tonight? How many remember that chorus I taught you this morning? It's real long. It has a whole lot of hard words in it. Do you remember that? I want to be ready. I want to be ready. I want to be ready to walk in Jerusalem just like John. Isn't that hard? Okay. We're preparing for the coming of the Lord. I want to be ready, I want to be ready, I want to be ready to walk in Jerusalem just like John. And I'm not going to spend all my time on electronic games, because I want to be ready, I want to be ready, I want to be ready to walk in Jerusalem just like John. Amen. All right, everybody got A+. God bless you richly and keep you and keep your mind in